Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
So Mona, I know a lot of EB5 investors are really concerned about two things. The first one is, how do I come into the U.S.? How do I bring my family into the U.S.? And how do I stay here in the U.S.? And the second one is, once the EB5 project and my EB5 package has done its job, how do I get out? You know, how do I exit? And I know a lot of that is covered in the private placement memorandum, but let's be honest, those are big, complex documents. I don't understand them.
You're absolutely right, Mark. The investor wants two things. He wants his green card and they want their money back. They want the return of their capital. And for most people I have seen, I know that a return on investment, meaning the interest rate, is important, but it's not the most important thing. The exit is the important thing. And there's no one better to discuss exit plans than our guest today.
That's right. Today we have Ronald Fieldstone. Ronnie is a partner in the Miami office of Sal Ewing, Arnstein & Lair, which is a full-service law firm with more than 400 lawyers serving businesses throughout the United States and internationally. Ronnie represents both developers and regional centers in EB5 matters and is currently handling more than 300 EB5 projects with a combined capital raise in excess of $7 billion. Ronnie, welcome to EB5 Investment Voice.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you, Ronnie. Let's jump straight into this. I know you've been handling a lot of EB5 projects and you've seen a lot of PPMs. You've drafted a lot of PPMs and you've seen a lot of creative exit plans. I don't think people give enough emphasis to the exit plan.
Correct. It's very interesting to see that lack of detail in offerings, but I think it's becoming a little more popular and demanded today. For instance, if you're in a loan program, which is most of the investments to date have been loan programs, but that's changing. We're seeing a lot more preferred equity programs. But if you're in a loan model, theoretically, your loan is repaid after a certain period of time. In the olden days, Mona, when we started practicing in this area, and you didn't have retrogression and USCIS was adjudicating in a reasonable period of time, it was estimated you would be in and out of a transaction and have 829 approval in 5 years.
Right.
And then therefore, most loans had a 5-year term. So if you're going back to 2010, 11, 12, maybe even 13, before retrogression hit in 2014, you were able to basically budget a 5-year loan with 1 or 2 1-year extensions. And that was a pretty easy exit. Okay,
right.
The loan gets repaid.
Yeah.
And then I have my 829 approval. And then to my NCE general partner or manager, new commercial enterprise, EB5 company, gives me back my money and we're all happy. I get my green card. I get my 829 adjudication. So I get my conditions removed. And then I get my money back because under the old rules, you needed 829 adjudication to get your money back, and you need to maintain your at-risk requirement.
Well, you know why? You know who we had, Leon Rodriguez, on the program? Was it Leon or was it Maury? I think it was Maury who said that they're the ones who actually set up the 5-year program. And the 5-year program, the whole idea behind the fact that your money was held for 5 years was because it really took 5 years for any business to stabilize.
That's well said, too. That's an economic model, which is well said, because you're correct. If you're developing any type of model, it may take you 2-3 years for construction and then 1 to 2 years to stabilize. And and then the developer was able to pay back the EB5 loan by refinancing the project in 5 years. So I think that's a very good comment that was made, that the 5-year model fit well into the economics, and EB5 capital was raised usually pretty quickly. And those initial projects seemed to work pretty well from a practical point of view, and the immigration issues did not really get in the way. Of course, all of that changed in 2014 in August when the retrogression hit China, and then all of a sudden the industry realized that, especially with China being in those days about 80% of EB-5 capital, right, that we needed to figure out how to maintain the at-risk requirement for an extended period of time, given the whole issue of retrogression, and now the delay of getting that final 829 adjudication, which then gave you a free pass to get your money back and get your permanent green card.
When you said maintain that risk requirement, was there something with the Chinese retrogression that was eliminating or taking out the risk?
No, no, it extended the risk. See, retrogression means that you're now delayed in getting your visa, which delays you coming in the country, which delays you getting your temporary green card. And then you have to wait for the 829 adjudication. Now, what happened, and Mona is the expert on this. I'll just make comment, Mona, you comment. Mona is the expert on this. I'm not. But the adjudication times were used to be short, and Mona, you would know better than me, and then they got extended, and all of a sudden, to wait for your 526 approval, then get your visa appointment, then come to the country for 2 years, and then file for 829, those adjudication times have been extended so dramatically that just by the government's delay in processing, the program's taken a lot longer to do a complete turn.
Yeah, but the thing is, Ronnie, this is so tied in with redeployment. And I really want to tell our listeners that we want to talk about redeployment at great length because it's so important. It's important for everybody to understand. It's important for developers to understand. And really, we are still all over the place with redeployment. But I want to just bring you back to one point, Ronnie. Time for the return of capital.
The olden days, exit were not that difficult. You had a loan model. You had about a five-year term with one or two 1-year extensions in case a developer needs a little more time to pay the loan off. By the time the loan got paid off, most of the investors would have their 829 adjudication and they would get their money and they had a fairly easy exit. That situation's changed because of the delay in the process. So the problem we have now is when you're making an investment as an investor in an EB-5 company that makes a loan, you have several issues. First issue is, will the project be in a position to still pay the loan back on a timely basis? And we have seen in the industry that as the industry expanded dramatically and more projects were getting done, projects were to some degree taking longer to actually get completed, stabilized, where they were in a position to pay off the loan.
Ronnie, I have something to add to that, though. And we have an earlier podcast, one of our early podcasts, we actually had a developer who has a number of real estate projects in New York City, but this was a reference to a hotel in Manhattan. What he told us, and he stated this on our podcast, what he stated was that if I'm refinancing to pay back the EB-5 investors, and if I don't get the figure that I want from the bank, I'm not going to refinance. I will wait because I'm not bound to pay back the investors at any particular time. So I will pay back when the figures are good for me. And I feel that, for example, with hotels, they didn't have the same kind of appeal once Airbnb came in. Nobody really could foresee that. There was a big glut of them in New York City. So they did not get the same kind of refinancing that they expected. So I feel that there was a delay in repaying some of the investors from the early projects. I'm not just feeling that. I know that. We have several projects where they took 8 or 9 years to return the payment, even though they really could have returned the payment much earlier.
Well, that's an interesting point, because don't forget, a lot of developer clients we represent at regional centers are in very much in favor of delaying repayment because EB-5 capital is fairly inexpensive compared to normal private equity capital, whether it's debt or equity, because mezzanine financing, we know the rate in traditional mezzanine financing is much higher than EB-5 mezzanine financing, which is typical because most EB-5 deals are not first mortgages, they're secondary positions. And therefore, what you said is exactly correct. It's to some degree in a developer's interest to keep cheap capital outstanding for an extended period of time to gain the benefit of a reduced interest rate on millions of dollars. So that's correct. Now, the key to this, now we go back to the comment you made earlier in the podcast. What did the offering document say?
Right.
What did the loan agreement say? When in the beginning of EB-5 world, you know, people didn't focus on the loan documents so much. In today's world, agents and investors want to see signed loan documents. They want to make sure they're properly done. And the disclosure of all the loan terms becomes a material component of the EB-5 offering.
That's right.
Part of the exit strategy. Yeah. It's extremely important. From my standpoint, we describe in detail the project, the capital stack, the timing, when the project's expected to be finished and finalized, and what obligation does a developer have to pay the loan off with extensions. And the investors need to be aware of that, because an investor must assume that the developer may take advantage and otherwise extend the loan as long as possible, given the relatively inexpensive financing that EB-5 provides.
But if I was an investor, and I'm asking you, but can they do that? And how do I find an investment which they're not going to take a long time to repay me?
That's a great question. I'll give you a few answers. Number one, somebody, either the agent or the investor, or whoever you're relying upon, needs to read the documents. And agents today are reviewing loan agreements and negotiating loan agreements because you need independence. So somebody's got or regional centers who are not the developer, who are very sophisticated, are in the business of, I make a comment, EB-5 is in the lending business. I actually tell people that, I've announced that. If you're in the EB-5 business, you're a lender. You're just lending with EB-5 money. You got to treat yourself like a lender. You as a lender have a handle on when that loan's going to be paid and what's your collateral and what's your protection. And somebody needs to enforce the loan documents. The problem we've had in the industry in the beginning was regional centers in the beginning were formed by developers to a large degree. Is that correct, Mona?
Well, no. The very, very beginning, they were not. They were third-party regional centers. Developers came in, I would say, after the initial investors came in. I mean, for New York, for example, the very first regional center was NYCRC, which was one of the ones that I was the original founding member. The second one was, which I also founded, was a developer, but they did more third party. Then the third, fourth, fifth, sixth started seeing the big developers doing their own, like Related, Extel, Lam. You know, these are developers who had their own projects and they just didn't want to pay interest rates to third parties.
Exactly. So what happened? And that's happened all over the country to some degree.
Right.
So what you have now, and you got to be careful, and we warn clients about that, you have a concept called the fox guarding the chicken coop. Now you have a problem because you've the developer, even if they're legitimate and want to do the right thing, have an inherent conflict of interest. How do you lend money to yourself? How do you enforce a loan against yourself? So we've seen the industry evolve where third-party administrators, loan administrators, are put into the equation. There are companies out there that will administer a loan independently and have authority to appoint attorneys if there's a default to enforce the rights under the loan agreement. So if you have a affiliated regional center manager, you need to create some degree of independence, always advisable. Number two is assuming you're an independent regional center, you need to make sure that you have the proper legal protections and financial protections, and that somebody is following the deal just like a bank and making sure that the money is properly spent, that the money does not go out the back door. Unfortunately, we've had some fraud cases in EB-5.
Of course.
Where the money has gone to the regional center manager and out the back door. It never went into the project. So we need to, the industry's gotten better. I think it's gotten better because they realize there's been too much fraud and too many problems, and the industry has demanded much more integrity.
It's also become much more savvy.
Yeah.
You're right. Correct. Agents and the investors are more savvy, and they want to see what protections are in place. They want to know who their developers are. They want to know developer track records. They want to see if developers have given back projects or gone bankrupt or defaulted in loans. They're doing their homework, because in today's world, anybody can Google anybody. And we find investors are very sophisticated. I never underestimate investors. And they are Googling information and getting back with concerns and comments. And that the developer will meet its obligations to timely repay a loan where that loan is now available. Those loan proceeds are now available to exit the investor out of the program.
And that really gets to the heart of what Mona was asking. How do the investors make sure that the time to get the funds back to them is done in a speedy manner?
And the answer is a tough one. I'll tell you what I mean by that. It depends what country you're from. Now, in India, I understand the Indian investor is much more independent and does their own independent review and their own independent diligence. Vietnam is probably somewhere in the middle. And other countries around the world vary, where the individual investor
There's a lot of trust, actually, which goes into these decisions at the end of the day. People do get confused and they just rely on trust. But I have a question for you, Ronnie. Obviously, for some time, many of the real estate projects do not want to have loans because they would rather have the debt shown as a preferred equity. It looks better on their books. So investors ask us all the time, is a loan model safer than preferred equity?
The answer normally would be yes. I say normally yes because debt primes equity, but I'll give you the reason why it may not be safer and that a preferred equity investment may be just as good as a loan model from a protection standpoint and economically may be a better investment for this reason. If you have a loan model and you have a senior loan, I've done a lot of intercreditor agreements. Intercreditor agreements are the agreements between the NCE, EB-5 NCE lender and the senior lender. And intercreditor agreements are pretty typical. They say, EB-5 lender, you're subordinating your collection rights, your loan, the payment of interest if the senior loan's in default, and you can't execute on your collateral until we're paid in full. So as a practical matter, you have a loan that you can't execute on. But that's standard in the industry. It's not anybody's doing anything wrong. The senior lender will not allow an EB-5 company to come in and take over a project because unlike a normal mezz lender, like a related has a mezz fund, well, they're very sophisticated. If they make a loan and take over a project, a senior lender is not going to have a problem because they have the strength and ability to run a project. They're experienced developers. When you look at a private equity deal, you have a whole different problem with exiting. Because if you don't make a loan, a lot different than a loan where you have a maturity date, and if the loan isn't paid on maturity, I can bring a legal action like any lender to enforce a loan. Technically, it's a lot easier to exit a loan than a preferred equity with the caveat that based upon senior loan documents, you may be stuck getting paid back for multiple years under the senior loan document. So we need to be aware of that.
So, Ronnie, what I'm hearing with the loan model, that's preferred if the loan is what you'll call an executable loan with a maturity date, unlike the loan that really isn't executable or enforceable as the way that you were explaining it. Is that the gist of when you'd want a loan and how you'd want that loan to look?
Correct. I mean, that's part of the diligence and that's part of the analysis of a good deal is to make sure there is certainty that documents are in place, that the time periods are fixed, and that the developer does not have unlimited discretion to defer payments under the loan or extend the loan, because then in that event, it's a loan, but it's really more like an equity investment is presented like a loan.
But there are certain types of projects that you cannot have a loan model for. For example, if there's a direct pooled project or it's an entrepreneurial project where you're not utilizing a regional center, you have to have equity. You cannot have a loan.
Let me talk about two different equity models. And one's a direct and one's a regional center. Let me go with the regional center first because that's more popular. A lot of times, senior lender will not allow junior debt, even at an upper tier level. So if you have a mezz loan, typically EB-5 makes a mezz loan. Some senior lenders say, I won't loan on that project with any debt, even at an upper tier level, because I want it to be equity. I'm underwriting this deal that the equity's in. I don't want the EB-5 investors group, the NCE, coming in and trying to foreclose on my developer's property.
Actually executing their loan.
Right, right. So if you become a preferred equity investor, one model, the regional center model, is you put your capital into an NCE, new commercial enterprise, and instead of the new commercial enterprise making a loan to the developer, the new commercial enterprise makes a preferred equity investment with a rate of return that's very equivalent to a loan model. That's perfectly fine. And if the project is ever sold or liquidated, then you as a preferred equity investor get paid first because you have preferred equity. Very similar to a public company preferred stock and common stock. Preferred stock trades at a fixed coupon, doesn't share in profits. Common stock gets a dividend that's discretionary, and on liquidation is subordinated to preferred. So
Ronnie, let's back up a couple seconds there. You mentioned if the project is sold or liquidated.
That's exactly the point I was going to make.
Thank you, Ronnie. So that's kind of out of the hand of the investor. So at what point, again, at the top of the show, we talked about their two concerns is getting into the country and then getting out of their EB-5 investment.
The answer, that's, so I'm raising the issue because of that reason, and you got it right. And by the way, just like you said, Mona, earlier, you may have a developer's attitude is, I want to keep the EB-5 in there, so I'm just going to refinance to a dollar amount that only pays off the senior loan and not the EB-5 investment. I'm only going to raise that much money because nobody can tell me otherwise. That way I refinance my project. I keep my EB-5 debt or preferred equity investment at a cheap rate on the books, and I just keep holding the asset and I never sell it. That is not an acceptable solution to an EB-5 investment. And I think that's where certain deals have not addressed the exit strategy.
Ronnie, though, it's partly because of USCIS too, though, because in paperwork that we have seen where the exit strategy is dealt with, I don't know how many times we've seen an RFE saying, oh, wait a minute, is this a redemption agreement?
Correct. And as a matter of fact, if you have what you cannot have, let me make this comment. I agree, Mona. And my understanding is the developer can have a right to pay back the EB-5. No problem at all. And you can always have the developer having the option to buy out the EB-5 because that's in the developer's control. There's no guarantee. But the EB-5 company could not have an absolute put right. Put right meaning they go to the developer and say, you must buy me out by such and such a date. Because first, that looks like a loan. And secondly, USCIS might call that, and even though it's not individually with each investor, a redemption. And that has a problem to it. So the model that we have created is an interesting model, which we have found has been accepted by USCIS. If you make a preferred equity investment for the term of 5 years with 1 or 2 year extensions, and a developer does not exercise their option to buy out the NCE entity, the NCE entity then has a right, a legal right, as a preferred equity investor, to require the developer sell the project.
Mm. That's an excellent point.
And we do that all the time. So, and you have a legal right. It can be enforceable. So it's a little like a loan model, because in a loan model, what do you do in a loan model? You file an action and you foreclose and the property sold. You have a forced sale. In this case, you don't have a forced sale, but you have a legal obligation to list the property and sell it after a certain period of time.
Right. But how would a convertible note work in such a circumstance, or would it not?
Well, that's an interesting question. Who gets to convert the note? I've seen convertible notes go both ways. Convertible notes can be converted by the NCE, and I've seen convertible notes where the developer can force the conversion. I've seen it both ways. So that's where the legal documents are critical, because there are developers that create a loan model, but say, at fair market value, I can make you convert to equity.
Yeah.
Oh, really? But some people do that. Now, that's not illegal or improper. It's just a business term. If this was a normal commercial transaction, that's a risk you take when you make a loan. Now, most convertible loans are done for the benefit of the holder of the loan because the deal is very successful. And normally you would want to convert your debt because the equity conversion price accretes an increase in value. Just like in public securities, if you have a convertible bond, converting to a fixed price common stock and the market goes up, it may be advantageous to convert and go to common stock. Same concept here, but you really got to look at the structure of the transaction to determine who has a conversion right and what are the terms. But again, you have the same problem. Assuming you convert, how do you exit? Because developers theoretically could say, look, I'm going to keep you as my investor forever. I have no desire to sell this project. I'm going to keep it indefinitely. Right? And legally, that's not illegal.
Yes, because right. They can do that.
In immigration law, there is no obligation to give investors back their money. It's a legal issue. Immigration doesn't require that your capital invested be returned to you. It just says your money has to be at risk.
Though, you have to have a chance of loss and gain, which is something a little different.
Well, you always have loss or gain. If you stay as equity, you always have a chance of loss or gain, always.
And even if you're forcing that liquidation event,
you
could force it at a loss. So your returns aren't guaranteed. You're basically writing in the guarantee or the ability to force that liquidation event.
Yeah, that's why pooled equity does have exit issues in that respect. Ronnie, we could carry on talking about this topic for at least another couple of hours, but I want to shift gears right now. November 21st is coming by. There's a lot of investors out there who are confused. They're looking at projects and they're feeling the pressure and they're feeling that I just can't make my mind up which project to go into. At the same time, And hopefully we've tried to address some of these points that investors should look at. But at the same time, there's developers out there who are feeling the pressure. They know that their project may not be in a TEA after November 21. What are they going to do? Any suggestions right now on guidelines as to how they should proceed? How do we change documents, exit plans relating to two sets of investments? Perhaps if you are on a TEA, investment 500, investment 900?
Mona, just to frame the question, you're asking what's the advice that Ronnie would give for the developers and regional centers, right? Not the investors?
Not the investors right now, yeah.
Yeah, so my advice is this. The first thing you do is you find out if the project qualifies as a TEA as of November 21st. And we, Mona, I know you can talk about it in great detail, but the TEA definition is pretty simple now.
Much simpler.
You can only use the project census tract and any adjacent census tract combined to get a TEA. And then an economist in 5 minutes can go to a screen and give you an answer. Does it work? It's pretty simple. So basically, if you're a TEA going forward at 900,000, the good news is the whole world's going to be 900. In other words, the competition will be 900 as of November 21st. You're not in a competitive disadvantage. If you're in a non-TEA and you go up to 1.8 million, I think you're done, because I don't think you can compete at 1.8 million in a typical transaction, because why would an investor invest 1.8 million compared to 900 to get the same result? Not a good move. So I think when we do our analysis, if the project's a non-TEA, we basically assume the offering is going to end on November 20th, unless new legislation comes in and changes the rules. And therefore, the documents are modified.
Perfect. We've mentioned this previously, Ronnie. So I think this is something that I really might like you to – I don't want to talk about modification documents in this episode. I just wanted you to touch on it.
So basically, under the new regs, obviously, there's a time limit for $500,000. So the implication to an investor and a developer is I may not be able to raise all the money I targeted for EB-5 – because after November 20th, I'm not sure if the market's going to allow, will support a 900,000 or potentially 1.8 million investment. Now, the advantage of the regulations, I'm going to say something that's a little interesting, is to some degree we have a run on the bank. What I mean by that is the degree of interest in EB-5 has dramatically increased worldwide in the short term for the next approximately 3 months to go.
2 months and counting. We should have a calendar.
Yeah, 2 months and counting. Yeah, we're at the end of August. We have September, October, and 20 days in November. So, you know, yeah, we're close. You're right. It's two months and 3 weeks maybe. So what's going on? This is your last chance ever, I repeat, ever, to bring your family in for $500,000. If you're on the sidelines in any country in the world, you may say to yourself, oh, boy, this is my last chance to play the game for $500,000, because the regulations were very clear. If you invest your money and file your 526 and it's filed by November 20th, you are grandfathered from the new regulations that take effect on November 21st.
If there's a 30 million raise and they only raise 10 million and 20 million now has to come from alternative financing, how does this put investors at risk? What's your opinion on that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So basically, assuming there's a risk factor because of timing that the developer will now not be able to raise their required capital, it goes back to the original transaction. Is this a project that can survive without EB-5, complete EB-5 financing? Because a lot of projects today going into marketplace take the position that we will do this deal once we take $1 of EB-5 money. We have backup financing, either debt or equity, to cover a gap of EB-5 funding, especially where you have a project where you're uncertain as to whether in the future EB-5 capital will be viable. And that's really the only solution. So if you're an investor, you must look at the documents to determine if there's a statement made that whatever EB-5 is not raised, the developer has figured out other ways to fill that capital stack to cover the deficiency.
Well, Ronnie, thank you so much for coming on EB-5 Investment Voice and talking about exit plans. Well, now's the time to exit the show.
I like the pun, though. That's a good pun.
I've been practicing my dad jokes. And you also brought up a very key and important point, and that is now's the time to work and jump into EB-5 if it's going to be a value and a benefit to you. And knowing and understanding the PPM and how to get out and get your money out is very important and paramount to that. So again, Ronnie, thank you so much for coming on EB-5 Investment Voice.
Thank you, Ronnie.
Pleasure. Look forward to joining you again.
Thank you for being with us today on EB-5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB-5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB-5 Investment Voice.